This is the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Before you do anything else, please go to reason.com/podcasts and subscribe to this interview program, along with Reason's two other great podcasts, The Reason Roundtable, a weekly rollicking conversation yell fest about the top stories of the week, featuring me, Matt Welch, Catherine Mangan Ward, and Peter Suderman, and also the Soho Forum Debates. It's a monthly audio-only version of a series of debates that we put on in New York City. We co-sponsor with the Soho Forum about all sorts of interesting topics, ranging from whether or not robots are stealing our jobs, whether sex work should be legal, whether drugs should be legal, whether Donald Trump should be impeached. You name it, it's all there. Please go and subscribe to The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie, The Reason Roundtable, and the Soho Forum Debates, all at reason.com/podcast. You can also go to SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, Apple, Google, wherever you get your podcasts. Tonight's podcast, and I should say I'm recording it at night, that's why I think it's the night, but it's actually today's podcast, is going to be all about the coronavirus. Do you have it? If you do, what should you do? How likely are you to get it because you don't have it? My speaker, my guest today is Ronald Bailey. He's Reason's longtime science correspondent. He is the person that I personally go to whenever I see or hear about something in the news that's related to science, medicine, biotech, you name it, that I cannot make any heads or tails out of. Ron Bailey will always show us the way. Ron Bailey, thank you for talking to me today on the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie.
I'm very happy to be with you, Nick.
Ron, when did you started at Reason? What, in like 1996, something like that?
I actually started in 1998, so it's been 22 years.
All right, there you go. And your first Reason story goes back even further than that, right? As a freelancer?
That's right.
What was your first story? Explain your bona fides. Why should anyone be listening to you?
Well, my first Reason story actually was a cover story on biotechnology, and it was about Jeremy Rifkin, who was trying to basically outlaw biotechnology at the time. It was 1984, and I've been covering that beat ever since, trying to explain to people why they shouldn't be afraid of biotechnology, among many other things.
All right. So, well, that's a good lead-in to talking about today's terror du jour, which is the coronavirus, or COVID-19. Ron, what is the coronavirus, and should we be terrified? Should we be hiding in our root cellars with all kinds of vinegar and homeopathic remedies surrounding us to protect us? How dangerous? What are we talking about here?
Well, first of all, the coronavirus is a virus that probably jumped over from bats into human beings in China. There are, as it turns out, four human coronaviruses that are circulating normally in the population, and they all essentially give us what we would normally call the common cold. Then, of course, most famously, there was the SARS coronavirus that jumped out of China as well, also probably out of bats. And it was actually quite terrifying because it had a death rate of about 10%. But because it was so virulent, the onset was very rapid. It was easy to detect, and people were able to be quarantined and protected at that time. So actually, the world was able to stop that particular infection from becoming a pandemic, possibly worse than the Spanish flu would have been back in 1918. But what about this current version of the coronavirus? It is considerably milder than the SARS virus, and it's still early days, so it's really hard to figure out how bad it's going to be relative to something, say, like regular influenza. But I don't think it's time to be terrified by it. We should be cautious. We should be looking out for it. You get your usual infection control advice. You know, wash your hands frequently. I do all the time. I'm something of a germaphobe. I actually believe that in the germ theory of disease, though apparently people who practice homeopathy and so forth may not. Mm-hmm. But in this particular case, how bad will it get to be? Interestingly, let's compare it to influenza, right? The current version of influenza, according to the latest statistics from the Centers for Disease Control, somewhere between 30 million to 45 million of my fellow Americans have had flu in the current 2019-2020 flu season. Of those, somewhere between 18,000 to 46,000 have died of the flu. That would roughly mean that one in 1,000 people who get the flu in the United States, this current version of it, have died of that illness. Of
course, wait, 1 in 1,000?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Well, that's not very much. If you think about it, it's 0.1%.
Okay. No, I mean, look, I copped at the beginning that I'm following you when it comes to science and math, but it just seems that seems like a lot of people to be dying of the flu these days.
Well, again, it's, you know, that's the outer boundary. Let's assume 45 million Americans came down with the flu, 46,000 mm-hmm. of them died of it. That would be 1 in 1,000.
Yeah. So, and now the Spanish flu in 1918, that was one of the last great super pandemics, right?
Right.
And that killed 50 million people worldwide.
Right.
So, and I'm reading, this was something at Reason.com put up by our colleague Jacob Sullum that said that, you know, there the case fatality rate or the death rate for that was somewhere between 2% and 5%. How many people are, you know, are estimated, and I realize all of this, you know, we're totally guessing here and things like that, but how many people have coronavirus or COVID-19 right now, and what is the death rate that's, you know, being assumed for that?
Well, the case fatality rate right now is somewhere around 2%. Mm-hmm. And this is based on the fact that these are, you've detected the number of people who've gotten the disease, and then you figure out how many of them died from it. The thing is that it's estimated that as many as 95% of the cases of the disease have gone undetected, which means that where the case fatality rate is based on just what you've been able to test for. And instead, let's say that there are several million people out there in the world who've already had this particular version of COVID-19. They had a cough, a wheeze, they got over it, you know, they drank plenty of fluids, they went on their way and infected some other people. But the fact is that some of the best estimates I've seen right now with regard to what is likely to be the death rate is about double to perhaps a little bit more than that, the flu rate at this point, which is not negligible. That's 1 in 500 people dying of it.
Right.
And in some of the worst case scenarios, it's 1 in 200. Again, it's not the Spanish flu, but it's not great.
Yeah. And now the types of people who die is somewhat morbid, but, you know, what the hell? The people who are most likely to get, not to necessarily to get sick with the coronavirus, but who get the virus and then die, you know, what characteristics do they tend to share?
Well, basically, they're older folks. Unfortunately, I happen to be in that demographic right now, so I'm not.
You know what? We're all older than we were, right? So, like, I guess we're all older.
But it is, it's people who are older and who also have underlying conditions like diabetes, cardiovascular disease, hypertension, kidney failure. Or respiratory illnesses. So if you have any of those conditions, it considerably boosts your chances of dying of it. For example, I've seen some numbers where people in their 80s, about 8% of people in their 80s who have acquired the disease die of the COVID-19.
So is this, you know, I mean, the epicenter or the origin point of this seems to be China. Is that because, I mean, is it all over the place and it just happened to kind of present in China, or why China as opposed to, Italy is obviously, Milan has had a big outbreak and they're, you know, Italy is shutting down a lot of things because of it. But, you know, why is it coming out of China?
Largely, what happens is that humanity has acquired most of our infectious illnesses from our association with animals, essentially. A lot of the diseases that have afflicted humanity came out of the fact that people used to sleep with their domestic animals. You know, the cows were in the barn underneath them and that kind of thing. So you would get smallpox, possibly from cows, as a vector for that. Well, in China, as it happens, and it used to be an epicenter for a lot of the flu viruses that we would get because of the close contact that when China was extremely poor, you know, only 30 years ago, people were living in very close proximity to both ducks and pigs, And those are great vectors for creating new influenzas.
Huh.
And so almost all the influenzas of the last 30, 40 years would have originated in China. And so in a certain way, this new coronavirus is exactly that sort of thing. Again, they have live markets with animals in very close proximity to people. And, you know, they slaughter them on the spot. And so it makes it a lot easier for those animals to transfer these viruses over into human beings.
So it's just one more place where China is beating us, beating America. Will Donald Trump, do you think? I know you're not a fan of Donald Trump, but will he insist on making America great again by, you know, the United States become a crucible of infectious diseases?
Let's hope not.
So, you know, well, let's focus a little bit more on China. The original cases or the outbreak seem to be in the Wuhan province. A lot of people have talked about, you know, over the past 15 or 20 years, as China has really kind of risen to being a global economic and kind of a force and political power, you've had people in the New York Times, such as Thomas Friedman, I think most famously, kind of rhapsodize about how great a semi-enlightened tyranny or autocracy can be to get shit done. You know, they can, build railroads and all of this kind of stuff almost overnight. What is the downside of an authoritarian regime when it comes to something like an outbreak of a seriously infectious disease like COVID-19 or coronavirus?
Right. Well, let's go back to the SARS outbreak back in 2002 and 2003. The Chinese government kept that tamped down. They would not let other people outside in the outside world know what was going on, and they didn't let the people inside the country know. It was an embarrassment to the government, in which case it got slightly out of control. It did manage to get across the globe, specifically into Canada and the United States. And it could have been disastrous if very strong quarantine measures were not taken in the Western world to prevent its spread. Apparently something similar to this happened with this particular disease, COVID-19, where the government was reluctant to admit the severity of it initially. And again, this might have been local folk who didn't want to tell the folk back up in Beijing, you know, oh, they've got a problem here. So what you have in a top-down centralized system like that is information control, which doesn't allow for the transparency you need to actually figure out what's going on and stop it early on.
So I'm not going to say it's a weird thing. It's kind of an awful thing, but the same society that gives you the ability to kind of tell people to jump and then they have to say how high, it also completely chunks up the ability to have open, transparent information sharing that would allow this stuff to be kind of made visible sooner and nipped in the bud.
Right. Right. On the flip side of it, if the World Health Organization numbers and the new numbers coming out of China are correct, the fact that they basically have put over 100 million people in quarantine seems to have reduced the transmission rate. The at least the reported number of cases every week is going down in China at this point.
But can we trust any of those figures any more than we trust, you know, their exchange rates and things like that?
That is a very good question.
And I guess another, you know, issue having to do with quarantines, and I want to talk about what the West what the United States is likely to do in response to all of this. But, you know, out of that 100 million people, do we have any idea of like how many of those people are legitimately possible cases of infection, or is that just become a pretext where the Chinese government can round up either large numbers of people to placate outside forces, or they're using it to sweep up troublemakers of a different sort?
I have not heard that they're using it as a punitive measure for sweeping up troublemakers at this point, though. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming that if you said something online that they didn't like, that would be a problem for you. But if, for example, imagine a world where we wanted to control the common cold. If for like 1 month, all of us had to stay home and could not talk to anybody except online, mm-hmm. the common cold would probably cease to exist.
Hmm. So that, and that's kind of, that's a friendly, you know, it's funny when you said quarantine, I was immediately thinking of, you know, kind of sci-fi movies, you know, where people are herded, they're taken out of their homes and herded into some kind of antiseptic camp or hospital or something. But in fact, most of the quarantine is just stay at home and don't talk to anybody.
That's right.
Well, how, so there's something like 90,000 cases, you know, acknowledged so far.
Right.
That's obviously a minor slice of, you know, the number of people who are actually infected. Is there a sense of how bad it's likely to get, or what are the different scenarios playing out on all of this?
Well, the various scenarios, will the quarantines work here in the United States? Apparently we missed this through bad planning, we'll just say. The Centers for Disease Control basically had focused almost all of the attention on trying to figure out who might be coming from China with the infection, and in fact had not created measures to see what if there might be any community transmission going on in the United States. And
what do you mean by community transmission?
That basically that it would start circulating, you know, among normal Americans who didn't happen to go to China.
I see.
So what, you know, if for example somebody had come who came with a mild case, I'm just spinning out a scenario.
Right.
Sometime in early January, they didn't know that they had the disease, and you know, they shook hands with people and so forth. And so you got a whole chain of very mild cases coming out of it. And this may be actually what's happening in Washington State right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the CDC simply wasn't looking there to see if that might be a possibility. They were focused on quarantining Americans and other people coming from China and putting them, you know, in these army bases for 14 days to see if they came down with the disease or not. And it's,
is that a function, I mean, or, you know, is that choice to focus on people coming from China, is that a, you know, was that a politically or ideologically driven position, or is it just a screw up by public health officials?
I think it's probably a bit of both. I'm sure that people in the CDC did not want to contradict the claims coming out of the White House about their brilliant efforts to control the transmission of the disease. So it probably just, the kind way to put it, it basically distorted their vision, and they didn't come up with a plan B to look at to see if there was going to be community transmission or not.
Yeah. How bad is it? I mean, you said when I asked how bad is it likely to get, it's really quite, we'll have to see, right? Because we don't know how effective or ineffective certain things are. But, you know, what kind of, can you make any kind of educated guess in the United States? You know, what are we looking at? Is this going to be like a particularly bad flu season, or is this going to be really something terrible, or is this going to be a lot of, you know, fear over something that doesn't really take root?
One way to think about it right now is what's going on in Washington State, which is that some of the best, you know, six people have now died up there, sadly enough. Mm-hmm. Almost all of them were older and or had other medical complications, which made them more vulnerable to the disease. But one of the estimates I've seen is that the current death rate and so forth implies that there may be as many as 1,500 people who have been infected in Washington State area at this point, who've gone undetected at this point. And if that's the case, it may already be impossible to quarantine in the United States. But that being said, and again, it's early days, and I don't want to be too Pollyanna about it. My best guess, looking at the severity of the disease and so forth, is it will be like a really, really bad influenza season at some point. That would probably be the worst case scenario.
So what does that mean? Can you put draw some detail on that figure? What's the last, not counting SARS, what's the worst kind of flu season we've had in recent memory, and you know what did that end up looking like?
Well, but we had a vaccine that could work on that particular point. We're not going to have a vaccine for this one, I'm afraid, for all kinds of technical and regulatory reasons. But for example, the H1N1 flu epidemic of 2009 probably would be a good stand-in for for what I'm thinking about, though this might be a little bit worse than that. You know, assuming an infection rate of several million people, you know, something like the current flu season, you might get, I don't know, 100,000 people dying of the disease, which, which is not great. But again, it's not apocalyptic.
So I guess I was just reading, or I heard a news account about how a bunch of American-based domestic air carriers have stopped flights to and from like Milan or from in northern Italy because of outbreaks there. Is that kind of behavior, does that make sense? Or what is a proportionate response from the American government and kind of American businesses, or, you know, when it comes to travel, when it comes to dealing with products or people from China at this point?
I think what the better way to try to handle the situation would be basically to figure out a very rapid test for the disease, so that you the proportion. I mean, right now it's a very crude way of trying to control it, is basically saying let's not have anyone move around who might be infected. But if you could quickly identify infected folk the way it was able to do with the SARS epidemic, then you would be able to allow commerce to move and people to move fairly freely.
Right.
And so
what goes into building out a diagnostic test? I mean, is this something that you can do, like, you know, a pinprick for, and you would know that you have it or not?
Actually, yes, you could do it that way. Right now, for example, South Korea, as amazing as it is, has already created drive-by, if you will, or drive-through testing facilities. If you think you have the disease, you can just drive up. They'll take a swab, test you, and get the information to you a day later.
Huh.
And why can't we do that here in the United States?
Well, why can't we? Explain.
Well, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, for some odd reason or other, decided they wanted to have the complete control of all the testing. And so what has happened is there's a centralized system, has been a centralized system, that's breaking up now because of the abject failure that's proven to be. But they basically wanted to have all the test results coming into their facility where it would be tested. It turned out that the test they devised had flaws in it and was not accurate. But now a lot of universities are developing their tests, and some private tests will be developed fairly soon as well. So that we should have a much better idea of the extent to which the infection has spread throughout the United States in another 2 or 3 weeks.
Is the Centers for Disease Control is generally regarded as a pretty good organization, though, right?
It is.
I'm pretty efficient particularly for a government agency.
Yes. It is.
So can we ask, I mean, you know, there were claims a bunch of Democratic politicians said, well, you know, Donald Trump cut the CDC budget, he got rid of this and that and the other thing. Is any of that at play here, or is that mere political camp?
Well, a bit of it is political camp, because it is true that the Trump administration has several times tried to cut the budget for the Centers for Disease Control, but Congress has always restored the budget, so that hasn't been the case. On the other hand, there were folks inside the White House who were tasked with keeping an eye on the possibility of pandemics originating in other parts of the world, and apparently those folks were removed 2 years ago.
Are there other pandemics that are either real or in the offing that we should be keeping an eye on? You know, one of the, I guess, you know, being a journalist for more than 15 or 20 minutes, much less 15 or 20 years, we keep hearing stories about, you know, okay, this time, you know, I realize it's not quite the same thing, but tuberculosis is back and it's worse than ever. You know, the Black Plague is coming back. This is coming back. That is coming back. Are there serious reasons to be very concerned that, you know, this time around it's COVID-19, it's coronavirus. Next year it's going to be something else and they're going to get deadlier and deadlier?
Well, there are always reasons to be concerned about infectious diseases, but my particular perspective on it is that we are so rapidly building out a biotech pharmaceutical platform system that we should be able to detect any of these things coming at us from far away and start reacting to it very quickly. If you think about this particular COVID COVID-19 virus, it's kind of amazing. If this had happened in the 1960s, we still wouldn't know about it. It would still be coming at us. It would be spreading throughout the world, and there would be almost no way of detecting it at this early stage of its development. It just simply wouldn't have been possible. And if you think about it, you know, one of the companies, Moderna Therapeutics, for example, was able to take the sequence of the virus and produce a vaccine that will be tested in human beings this coming month in only 42 days.
Wow.
And should be able to speed that up even more as the 21st century goes on.
What holds back on that? I mean, that all seems about as quick as possible. You know, what are the types of things that we should be doing policy-wise to allow for an even more rapid response to, big threats like this?
There should be, and there are some efforts in this direction, and I hope that, for example, what's happening now will spur this on. With regard to vaccine development, it should be able to come up with what they call platforms to develop, if you will, vaccines. Essentially, we should get a better handle on how human immune systems operate and how infectious agents operate, and should be able to figure out how to create fairly quickly a vaccine and manufacture it and disperse it very quickly within months, if not weeks, in the future. As it is now, it looks like right now, it takes 10 to 18 years to get a vaccine to market, believe it or not.
Wow.
Typically.
Wow.
In this particular case, if it becomes a public health emergency of a huge sort, they could probably roll this out in 12 to 18 months.
Why don't we treat all drug development as if it's a pressing public health need? I mean, you know, with the idea of taking 10 to 18 years to bring a drug or a vaccine to market seems insane, but you know, we patiently wait for all kinds of new pharmaceutical treatments that take that long. Shouldn't we be trying to speed up all of this stuff to treat all things that can be treated as if it's, you know, the world ends tomorrow?
I agree with you, obviously. Progress is going vastly too slowly for me. But the problem, of course, is prioritization. There are only so many resources that can be devoted to so many problems. And so it's really hard to figure out which way to prioritize things. On the other hand, infectious diseases are no joke. We should be thinking about those all the time.
Right. Is the pulling back a little bit, the Centers for Disease Control or the FDA? And I realize, you know, these are not exactly, you know, they're not treated in the same way. They don't have the same relationship to the president. Donald Trump, when he came into office, was, you know, talking a very big game about deregulating the FDA and about the kind of pipeline that allows for the invention and testing, distributing and marketing of pharmaceutical drugs or of new drug treatments. Scott Gottlieb, his original FDA commissioner, has stepped down a little while ago and is very vocal about, you know, how to deal with what's going on now. But is this a better environment than before Donald Trump was in office for kind of the development and deployment of pharmaceuticals?
The answer is probably yes, actually. When Gottlieb was the head of the FDA, he spurred many efforts to getting drugs approval speeded up. I mean, he really was fairly good at that. And again, it's a bit too slow, but he made considerable progress in that regard over what had been existing in prior administrations.
So let's end this discussion, if we may, by can you give, what are the things, you know, there with something like this, you know, there is the broad kind of top level domain reaction, which has a lot to do with what governments do, with, you know, what policymakers at the highest level do. What can individuals do? Like, what, you know, what should people be conscious of in order to minimize the chance that they get the disease, that they get COVID-19, or if they do, that it doesn't progress to, you know, a really dangerous level?
Well, it's always the simple stuff. Wash your hands, wash your hands, wash your hands. You know, be aware of the fact, and this is something that we all do, you're always touching your face, your nose, your mouth, and so forth, and that transfers the disease. And frankly, monitor your social network. If your friends happen to come down with the disease or so, they should let you know so that you will be able to monitor yourself as well.
If you're friendly, and I just touched my nose, so now I feel like I infected myself. But if you're talking with somebody and they're like, oh yeah, I just came back from China and I tested positive for coronavirus, should you immediately go to the doctor? What when you say monitor for symptoms, what do you mean by that?
Well, here's an interesting thing. It's not yet known for sure whether or not the people can pass on the disease in a pre-symptomatic stage. That is, they may not even have a cough, a sniffle, or a fever, and it might be possible that they don't know that they're passing on the disease at that time.
Right.
But if they do become aware of that, they should contact their physicians, and who will then try to do a contact tracing to see whom else they might have come in contact with over time, and then alert them to monitor themselves as well.
Do you worry? I mean, I guess we still do that. I'm thinking back to like high school level health classes. That kind of stuff is done when people have certain types of venereal diseases, right?
Right. That is correct.
Do you worry at all in this kind of context where, we're both good libertarians and whatnot? What is the kind of civil libertarian intersection here? Like, do we kind of throw out the window because this is is truly a public health concern? How do we kind of modulate public health and civil liberties?
Well, again, it depends on the severity of whatever it is we're talking about. If for example, the Black Death were to be were to return, we would have to be fairly severe about it because the fatality rate of the Black Death was somewhere around 100%.
Wow.
If it's the common cold, then I think I would prefer that my colleagues who have a cold stay at home and not work in the office. But,
reason is pathbreaking here because since so few of us actually work together, we might survive. We might become the last magazine standing, depending on what other people work, what other publications work situations.
Are you suggesting we're already self-isolating?
I don't know. I didn't realize we were doing it for any reason other than kind of antisocial behavior and, that it was cheaper than having a large central office. But so any other words of wisdom from Ron Bailey on dealing with the coronavirus?
Don't panic. Again, it's way too early to panic about it. Think about monitor it, listen to the news, keep track of what's going on. Again, my best estimation and subject to revision with new information is if quarantine fails, if in fact it's not able to be controlled, it will probably result in something like a fairly severe bad flu season, but it's not apocalyptic.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. We have been talking with Ron Bailey, the longtime science correspondent of Reason magazine, Reason.com. Go to Reason.com and check out his work and other people's works on the coronavirus COVID-19. This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. I want to thank you for listening, and I want to urge you all to please subscribe to this podcast at Reason.com/podcasts or at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, you name it, and be calm and be cool.